Tatagate. Moving on now with another phase of exposition on the fascinating subject of cosmic projection, Vamana. Now, I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing that word correctly. I must admit, in case you haven't gathered so already, that I'm certainly not a Sanskritist, and that I cannot fluently read and write Sanskrit, far from it. I do know probably some hundreds of Sanskrit terms, and probably some between 50 and 100 of them quite intimately. Recently, I read a biography of Sir John Woodruff, and I was surprised to learn that he himself could not fluently read and write Sanskrit. Rather, like myself, he knew a lot of terms by heart, and he knew the implications of those terms. Some of these Sanskrit terms that refer to the working parts of cosmic projection, the tattvas, are extremely technical and precise. And it takes years to master a knowledge of what these terms mean and to be able to use them competently and confidently. Well, John Woodruff was able to do that without, however, becoming a Sanskritist as such, without becoming fluent in the language. And it appears from this biography that I read, which I trust, that he actually had a ghostwriter who collaborated with him on a number of his books, which, as you know, present a vast scope of tantric metaphysics and tantric Vedic noetics. So there you have it, Vamana. If you go on the internet and you ask how to pronounce Vamana, some sites will come up which offer you various pronunciations that people have supplied to that site. They're all different, and in my opinion, they're weak and inaccurate. So I take the pronunciation of Vamana, where the V and the W, the V is close to a W, you catch that, from a YouTube channel which appears to be dedicated to a genuine and, what shall I say, authentic pronunciation of Sanskrit words, Vamana, obviously a word I enjoy saying. Cosmic projection, emanation. It's also called parinama. So, in this third talk on the unit dedicated to cosmic projection, I just want to establish a few points of orientation so that we can proceed at ease, knowing that we're all on the same page here, knowing that you are getting these terms and you're getting the metaphors in the way that I intend them. So what are the metaphors for the description of cosmic projection? Primarily, there are two. One of them refers to a movie theater with the projection booth that contains the equipment that projects the film image on a light beam through an aperture in the wall at the back of the theater onto a flat screen in the front of the theater. So there's the analogy of the theater and the booth. And the other analogy, of course, is to a device, an apparatus, that records a holographic plate, as well as a device that projects the image recorded on a holographic plate. So I refer to both of those devices, and I have provided photographs of the first device, that is to say, the device in which you take an object like an apple or a statue of a squirrel, take a three-dimensional object, and you holographically imprint that object on a plate, which can then be taken out of the device, put into another device, and subjected to a process by which it reproduces the holographic image of the original object. So just picture that, an original object to be reproduced, the holographic plate needed to reproduce it, and then the hologram, I think that's the standard term, the hologram, which is the result of the reproduction process. So what I'm going to talk about in this particular third audio for this unit is the first analogy of the theater and the projection booth. Now, I've been actually, how can I describe this? I've really been relishing telling you the moment to tell you what I can tell you now. I'm telling you because I can tell you. And it's so delightful to me to be able to look at this diagram that I have in front of me of the 36 tattvas, which I must have constructed around 1972. I do recall that I sent a letter to Dane Rudjar, famous astrologer of the time, in which I told him about my tantric studies, and I certainly said something about the 36 tattvas, and I may have included this comprehensive scheme in the letter to him. In any case, here's the scheme. I have it in my hand. I haven't put it up on the site yet. And it has, of course, the usual Sanskrit lingo that identifies the working parts of the cosmic projector, as well as the operations of projection that occur on the theater side of the world event, on the theater side of cosmic projection. The world event, in fact, is what happens on the theater side of cosmic projection. And so I have the whole scheme here. And I can tell you now, to your great relief, I'm sure, that it's completely unnecessary for you to master the various 36 Sanskrit terms that identify the working parts of the system. Not at all. In fact, I'm going to replace them immediately the moment I mention them. I may only mention one of these terms one time or a few times, and after that I won't mention it again because I'll replace it by a more user-friendly term. For instance, at the summit of the 36 tattvas, you have numero uno, which is the source of all that exists, all that manifests in inconceivably infinite numbers of worlds, and is the same time the ground of awareness that pervades all those worlds. So the name for the source beyond infinity and the ground of everything that is manifested from the source is Parasamvit, which is happens to be my favorite name for it. There are various other names for it, obviously. There are dozens. Brahman, not Brahma, but Brahman is another name for it. Gurdjieff would have called it the absolute, and many philosophers who are theists or deists and did not want to use theological terminology, specifically the word God, would call it the absolute, or the ground, or the urground, in terms like this. So I propose that we make a switcheroo from the Vedic Sanskrit Parasamvit to the originator. So you see here, I'm doing what I love to do, what I tend to do in my fancy and fanciful manner, which is to convert into terms of Gnostic cosmology. So the source beyond infinity of the infinite worlds is the originator, and the originator is the source of the aeons, or generators. The originator, in the analog of holography or holographics, is the light and power source. Bear in mind, the source of the light, the projector light of the movie projector in the projection booth, and the source of the electricity or power that powers that device are the same. That's the originator. Now, when you consider the analogy of the theater as a way to picture to yourself how cosmic projection works, then, of course, you always bear in mind what happens on the booth side and what happens on the theater side. I believe that I may have originally said that there were 13 of the 36 tattvas operating on booth side. Actually, there are 14. So the first 14 tattvas, or working parts of the projector system, are obviously in the projection booth, and they are all located booth side, behind the wall that divides the projection booth from the theater where the spectators sit. Now, there is, of course, the unique feature of the vertical rectangular slit in the wall. Remember that? Can you remember ever having sat in a theater, in a movie theater, in the old days when they worked with projectors, and looking back over your shoulder and you would see a slit, a rectangular slit, vertical, and behind that somewhere you would see a light source, round, bright, and often flickering. Special attention goes to this feature. You'll see when I get to that eventually, and it will be probably in the course of this talk, why not, that the location and positioning of the projector lens is extremely interesting in cosmic projection. But for now, before I go to that detail, let's just establish that there are 14 working parts of the projector, the cosmic projector, on the booth side. And the remaining parts, or aspects, components, features of cosmic projection are on the theater side. Now, in the parable of the two yogis, which I haven't got to yet, I don't know, it may not be necessary to devote a separate talk to that little anecdote. But in the parable of the two yogis, the story goes like this. There's an epic movie playing at the theater on the flat screen, and it has a great range of characters in it. And among those characters are two yogis who appear on and off through the various scenes and episodes and sequences of the movie. And they seem to be sort of odd fellow travelers. They don't necessarily get involved in the plot of the movie. And at a certain point, they notice together that the movie that they're in is actually being projected from somewhere. And how do they notice this? Well, they appear in a number of scenes mingled with other people and as if they were ordinary characters in the movie. However, being yogis, they have a tendency to seek the light. And so, off and on, they look out from the screen in the middle of a scene. For instance, there might be a big dinner party scene going on. The two yogis are sitting down in the corner in their orange robes, down in the corner on a couch, sort of away from the rest of the action of all these other characters milling around. And they're talking to each other, and they keep looking out from the screen. And one of them says to the other, "Hey, do you notice something out there?" And the other one turns and looks and says, "Yeah, it's like a flickering light out there." So just as the story is, that they notice that they are figures on a screen, and their yogic abilities allow them to detect that they appear as figures on the screen due to being projected from a lens using a current of light. And so they decide, once they have established this remarkable fact, they decide that they're going to go up that beam of light and try to investigate what's going on up there. So not only do they detect the flickering light of the lens in the aperture on the wall of the back of the theater, but they see the beam of light coming down and projecting themselves on the screen, and they decide to use their yogic capacities, and only yogis can do this, to travel up the beam. So they go up the beam, through the wall, into the lens, and into the projector. And they proceed using their yogic siddhis, capacities for concentration, the occult powers of observation. They proceed to meticulously investigate all of the 14 working parts of the projector in the booth. And gradually, eventually, they arrive at Parasamvit, or they arrive at the power and light source of the entire projection event. So these yogis do this, as many, many countless unnamed yogis, and some named, are presumed to have done this feat of exploration over many, many centuries. And when they return to the world of ordinary life, they come back to the hermitage, to the ashram, they come back to the forest grove, wherever it is that the yogis gather, and they shop talk about what they saw. Needless to say, what they saw was, in some respects, tremendously complicated. And so when they come back from that experience, and when they attempt to formulate what they have seen and experienced in words, the result is an enormous amount of technical jargon. And that is exactly what you find in the Vedic teachings and in the Hindu tantric physics, as I used to call it. To be found in the writings of Sir John Woodruff and others. You find literally hundreds of technical Sanskrit terms referring to the working parts and the different operations and connections between the working parts. Now, fortunately, in the schematic of the 36 tattvas, which are eventually going to be ogling, much to your delight, you will find that there are really only 36 words. But in fact, when you get into the physics, the occult physics of the projection of the world event, well, there are many, many other technical terms referring to how it works and how it is set up, referring to the structure and dynamics of cosmic projection. For right now, for this moment, however, I invite you to picture the part of the cosmic projector that projects through the aperture in the wall of the projection booth. Now, I believe that in classical movie theaters, the snout or lens of the projector, the nose of the projector, was actually inside the booth. It was behind the wall. It didn't stick out through the rectangular aperture, did it, as far as I know? In any case, the setup with the cosmic projector is a bit different. In fact, the lens of the cosmic projector, I'm calling it the lens, the projective lens, the cylindrical extension of the projector toward the screen, can you picture that, is a most fascinating construction. So the two yogis discovered. And that construction is preserved in the system or scheme of the 36 tattvas. And it looks like this. Imagine that the cylindrical extension of the projector, like a nozzle, right, which is the passage for the light beam that will go into the theater and project the movie on the screen. Imagine that that cylindrical device consists of three parts. It has three sections to it. And these sections are called, in traditional lingo of the 36 tattvas, buddhi, ahamkara, and manas. And they are 15, 16, and 17 of the working parts of cosmic projection. Now, as I prepare to load this audio onto the unit, I'll look around on the internet for an image of an old-fashioned movie projection device. And you will see that indeed it has that feature, the lens, which is a cylindrical device, kind of like a snout. Now, the lens of cosmic projection is constructed in a really fascinating way. Due to the fact that it has three working parts locked together. One way to picture this is to picture picture what is called glass bottom lenses. You know, some people who have very poor eyesight need to have very thick lenses. And these lenses have been compared to the bottom of a glass bottle, such as a beer bottle or a soda bottle, because they're very thick. And very often they have a flat side and a concave side, or they may have two concave sides. So just picture that there are three such bottle glass lenses locked together to form this cylindrical column. Now, each of these three lenses processes the light that is coming from the projector, from the light source. They process the light and they organize the light in a particular way. So the light source that is streaming into the lens on the booth side has to be organized in a certain way so that it produces the world event on the theater side. Trying to explain this in metaphysical terms and using the technical jargon of Vedic philosophy, the technical jargon of Patanjali or any of the yogic masters, is next to impossible. You could study it for 20 or 30 years and actually not be able to make much sense out of it. But with the analogy to the lens nozzle, the lens light nozzle of a projector, it becomes eminently simple. Each of the three parts of the lens is itself a lens that does something. So imagine that there is a beam of light coming into the lens from the projector, that is to say, from the preceding 14 working parts of the projector. From that construction of 14 working parts, there proceeds a beam, and the beam goes through this triple lens. And at each one of the lenses in the triple construction, it undergoes a certain transformation. So, the first lens that is closest to the projecting device spreads the light beam into a field. It spreads it into a vast perimeter of light. It expands it as if you would open an umbrella. It expands the beam of light into a full spectrum perimeter of light. But bear in mind that that full spectrum perimeter of light is still on the other side of the wall of the projection booth. So when you're in the theater and you look back, you don't see that because it's just behind the wall. Next comes the middle lens, the middle part of the triple lens. This is called Ahamkara or Ahamkara, which means a bridge, also translated as the internal link. So this working part of the projector in the lens cylinder, part 16, is actually a component that connects the rearward lens, buddhi, with the forward lens, manas. But it doesn't just connect them. It also has a certain particular lensing function itself. And this function is known in science and physics as parallax. So it gives parallax properties to the projection of the world event. And it is a fact that everything you see in the world event, particularly at large distances, is subject to parallax, which is a relativity of position. This relativity of position that you see in the world, astronomers pay a great deal of attention to it as they observe the cosmos over vast distances. This relativity is not merely a property of the cosmos that happens because the cosmos happens to be there. It is a property of the projective light that causes the world event to be there. In other words, parallax is a phenomenon, an action. It is not merely an attribute of the cosmos to be observed. And this action, this phenomenal property of the world event, is produced by this working part that links the rearward lens and the forward lens. So just try to picture that for a moment. Picture, for example, a thick lens, two thick lenses that are relatively identical, and then lock them into a framework that is also constructed of crystal and metal. So you have one lens at one end of the framework, a cylindrical locking device. You lock them into the two ends of a cylinder. And the cylinder itself is not just something that locks the two lenses and holds them in place at a distance from each other, but it also has a lensing function. Clear enough? Now we come to the forward lens, the one that is closest to the theater. And here the yogis discovered something really, really remarkable. They discovered that in the total construction of booth and theater, the lens of the projector extends into the theater. So physically, this is how you picture it. There is a lens attached to the projector behind the wall of the booth. There is a connecting lens that comes right up to the aperture that opens into the theater, and the third lens actually protrudes into the theater. The third lens, which is called manas, which is the 17th working part of cosmic projection, actually extends into the theater. It's on the theater side of the wall that separates the theater area from the projection booth. Now, this detail has, I have to tell you, it's my pleasure to inform you that this detail has momentous and stupendous consequences. This detail of the construction of the mechanism of cosmic projection has momentous consequences for the way things work. And particularly, it has huge consequences for the human animal's effort. It has huge consequences upon the human animal's effort to know how cosmic projection actually works. Now, when you have a clear picture in your mind of this whole setup, And you can distinguish easily the difference between what's happening booth side and what's happening theater side. Then you can focus in and concentrate on the aperture in the wall of the projection booth. And you can picture how the lens is positioned exactly relative to that wall, and how one end of it, one third of it, comes out beyond the wall and actually extends into the theater. I assure you, with that picture in mind, you can discern and distinguish and comprehend pretty much everything that can be known about the mystical experiences of enlightenment, illumination, Sambodhi, which is the Sanskrit name for enlightenment, Samadhi, the trance of Samadhi, the high yogic trance in which the yogi must be in a catatonic state. Basically, what the analogy teaches you is that there are two areas of the cosmic event that have been investigated and described by mystics through the ages. So what is the difference, for example, between the enlightenment of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree and the enlightenment or illumination of Indian yogis who penetrated all the way to the light source? What is the difference? Now bear in mind that those two yogis who went up the light beam left the theater. When did they leave the theater? Well, they left the theater as soon as they got to Manas, which is working part 17, the end of the lens that extends into the theater. When they went past Manas, along the bridge of Ahamkara, which is a parallax lens, to Buddhi, they were no longer in the theater. And the consequence of that was that they were no longer active kinetically and cognitively as human animals are designed to act. To put it in plain English, they went into catatonic trance. Samadhi is catatonic trance. The only way that you can explore what is inside the projection booth, the 16 working parts from Ahamkara all the way back to the light source, is in Samadhi. And Samadhi is a state of illuminated trance. But you can't function. You're no longer in the theater. You're no longer active in the world event, theater side, if you are able to perform the yogic activities and acts of concentration and navigation which permit you to go into the workings of the cosmic projector. So, what about those kinds of mystical experiences of illumination and enlightenment that are possible theater side? You see, that's a whole different area of exploration. And the very best example, and by far the most pertinent and significant example of the difference between mystic illumination booth side and mystic illumination theater side is guess who? That would be Siddhartha, Shakyamuni, Gautama, the historical Buddha. You see, the historical Buddha, although he was Indian and came from a Vedic background, when he underwent his process of meditation for 6 or 7 years, which was not long, by the way, some of those yogis who managed to get into the depths of the projector would meditate for 20, 30, 40 years, 50 years. I kid you not, you know. By some accounts, hundreds of years. And they would go into suspended animation, like the rishis. When you hear about these legendary accounts, you're hearing about yogis whose practice was so extensive that they could enter samadhi and stay in samadhi, and they could, in fact, navigate around in samadhi, although they couldn't navigate around in their physical bodies. Now, compare that type of experience, which we're going to call samadhi, with enlightenment, sambodhi. How does the enlightenment of the Buddha compare to the samadhi of those yogis on the other side of the booth? Well, it thrills and delights me to tell you that the enlightenment of the historical Buddha represents a state of mystical illumination and mystical awakening that only extends to the lens. The historical Buddha only saw as far as the lens. He did not see into the cosmic projection device. He did not go there and explore it as the two yogis do in this little parable. The experiences and states, emotional states, physiological, physiochemical states, cerebral, neurological states, neuroelectrical states, the modalities of awareness and the various bhava or states or conditions that can be undergone in samadhi are different from those to be undergone theater side. Samadhi is a booth side mystical experience. Sambodhi, typically the enlightenment of the Buddha, is a theater-side noetic experience. There's a difference between noetics and yogic paraphysics. I would call it paraphysics, metaphysics, mystaphysics. The mystical physics of yogic trance, booth side, involves a whole different set of experiences and a whole different set of terms from what can be experienced theater side. The beginning of the takedown of Buddhism, which comes with the Dragonfly Sutra and Maitreya Challenge, is just this distinction, the illumination of the Buddha only went to the lens. And seeing the lens and seeing the brilliance of the lens, the Buddha presumes, it may be presumed, that the Buddha presumed that he was looking at the source of the universe, But actually, he was only looking at the 17th working part of cosmic projection. And he took the light of the lens for his enlightenment. He took his experience, which was moderate and proximate, as something that was ultimate. And as a result of that being so, as a result of him making that error, everyone who followed in his tracks made that error and compounded it. For example, there is a tendency in Buddhist writings and Buddhist commentaries, not so much in the earliest and authentic sutras, but in the enormous mass of commentary on those sutras, the blah, 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 the yada, 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 there is a tendency to use terms that describe working parts and processes both sides. But in fact, the noetics of enlightenment coming from the historical Buddha do not include what happens both sides. The enlightenment of the Buddha, the true and genuine enlightenment, if indeed there was such a thing, is a noetic experience of the working of the mind, manas. And that's theater side, because manas is the part of the lens that protrudes into the theater. Now, when you can know the difference conceptually, and when you can picture it using this wonderful analogy, I have to tell you that you know something that is just not known. It has not been known until now. It has not been able to describe this difference in this way until now. Strangely enough. So everything that happens coming out from that lens, working part 17, and working its way from 18 to 36 in the remaining functions or tattvas that are operating theater side, all of that belongs to a realm of experience that can be described by certain terms in Buddhism. But other terms in Buddhism are misleading and false because they presume to talk about what is happening both sides. But the enlightenment of Siddhartha did not extend to both sides. And in that way, it differed profoundly from the mystical adventures of his Vedic predecessors. The many yogis and mahatmas of the land of India, of Bharat, who lived before him and who were his contemporaries, were all dedicated to getting to samadhi, and from that state, they could explore the internal workings of cosmic projection. But Siddhartha, who became Shakyamuni, did not explore any of that. And none of it can be adequately explained in Buddhist metaphysics. None of it. As a matter of fact, according to the bottom line of Buddhist metaphysics, Buddhist noetics, if you want to call it that, the mind creates everything. Well, that's as if we were sitting in a movie theater watching a film, and we see the story unfolding on the screen. Of course, due to certain, undeveloped aspects of consciousness, we don't realize that we are also part of the movie. But out of curiosity, you just turn around and look back. Oh, and you see this bright light, this hard bright light, this circular light in a dark aperture in the wall behind us. And we think that that point of light, that circle of hard bright light, is the source of the movie. But it isn't, is it? Obviously, it's not the source of the movie. In fact, it's simply the aperture where the cosmic projection machine releases the movie. It's the aperture of projection, but the aperture of projection, which the Buddha reached in his meditation, is not the mechanism of projection in its totality. It's just the place where the projection of the world event surfaces externally and externalizes into the theater. And that is what the Buddha experienced. But he took it for much more than that, apparently. I don't know. I haven't talked to him lately. I can only speculate about certain things here, certain aspects of this weird, weird situation. For instance, did the Buddha actually stop at Manas, the lens, knowing that it was the lens, and knowing that beyond it was the zone of cosmic projection which many Vedic yogis had reached? Did he consciously say, I'm not going there, I'm just going to stop at the lens and I'm going to talk about everything that happens from the lens coming forward to the screen because that's enough for my purposes? So was it an intentional decision on his part? Did he set a boundary? Or was he in fact incapable of going as far as the two yogis went? And instead of realizing that he didn't go the whole distance to the originator, he mistakenly believed that he saw all there was to see regarding the event of cosmic projection. Now, it raises a lot of really interesting questions, doesn't it? And of course, these questions can never be answered, short of reviving that individual and having a face-to-face conversation. But what you can be certain about, and this is the takeaway, is this. When you use this picture to maintain the distinction between samadhi and sambodhi, between trance illumination in the booth and noetic illumination of the workings of the mind and mental projection in the theater, you are a crown prince. And a crown princess of vidya, or wisdom. You are a vidyadhara, someone who holds vidya, wisdom, in your body and in your mind. In order to hold wisdom today, you must hold this distinction. This distinction is the root of wisdom today, vidya, which is the Sanskrit correlate to sophia. That distinction is incomparable and unparalleled in its teaching value. So it's great delight for me to be able to share that distinction with you. And now you're in the know, so you will know that my takedown of Buddhism relies very strongly on this assertion. It relies on everything that I said in the 54 minutes of this talk, but particularly it relies on the observation that the third part of the projector lens extends into the theater, and that is as far as Gautama went. As far as I can tell, it's also as far as anybody else who followed him has gone. For instance, there's a really, really important detail in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And the Tibetan masters, including the Dalai Lama, make a very big deal about this. And they talk about seeing the light, seeing some kind of light. The Dalai Lama talks about two kinds of light. It would be a good idea if I got around to that topic in the course of these expositions. Personally, speaking as the humble animal that I am, I have to admit I have some problems with what the lamas and Rinpoches and Karmapas say about light. In any case, in regard to commentaries on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, one of the points that they make very strongly is that the departing entity, the departing soul, or whomever, going into the bardo, the after-death zone, should go toward the hard light, the hard, glassy light. They talk about a hard, glassy light. It's not clear whether this light is white or whitish or pale or opaque or simply clear. Most often they say it's clear, but it's hard. Well, this hard, clear light is the light that you see coming from the lens, manas. It is not the light that is circulating through the projection machine in the booth. That's a different kind of light. And so this detail about the hard, clear light is just one of probably a dozen points that I could discuss if we had the next 5 months to do this, which would illustrate the value of this brilliant distinction between the operations of cosmic projection on the booth side and the operations on the theater side. And once you have that distinction, then you can also sort out the reports and records of experiences of yogis and mystics of all times and ages to determine if they saw something on the theater side or on the booth side. So I'll leave it at that for the moment. It's a lot to take in, I know. But I can assure you that once you take it in, it makes a lot of other things a hell of a lot easier to comprehend.